Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
One day, all of the facts in about 30 years' time will be published.
When genocide has been carried out in this country almost with impunity, and when it is near to completion, people talk about intervention.
You don't get freedom peacefully. Freedom is never safeguarded peacefully. Anyone who is depriving you of freedom isn't deserving of a peaceful approach.
Hello and welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt.
Human trafficking and modern slavery at the top of the news in the United States in the form of the QAnon conspiracy. It links together Democrats, child sex trafficking, and a pizza place about a mile from my house. The pizza at Comet Ping Pong is just okay, and they don't have a back room in the basement, but QAnon has lingered on. It's one of the most wacko things that we've got going on. We even have members of Congress who believe in it. Today, we're going to talk about the reality of human trafficking, though, and how it actually works. We're joined by Kieran Gilbert, who covers human trafficking and modern slavery for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. I worked for Kieran and learned a lot from him. So thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on, Jason. Thanks, Matthew.
Can we start with the basics, the absolute basics? When we say human trafficking, modern slavery, what do we mean?
So it's a difficult one to define quite simply, because human trafficking is the older, more established crime. And then human trafficking is based on three things. That's the act, the means, and the exploitation. So the act could be recruiting someone or transferring them and harboring them. The means is how you do that. So it can be through coercion, through fraud, or through deception. And then the exploitation is the form of abuse. So that can be sexual exploitation, or that can be forced labor. Now, what kind of complicates the picture slightly is you have this modern slavery as this umbrella term, which has really gained in popularity over the past, about decade. And it's a bit of an umbrella term. Under modern slavery, you have forced labor, you have debt bondage, very popular in countries such as India, where people are trapped in exploitation by debts. That can be debts they take from a money lender, or that can be debts that have gone through generations of families. So kind of, it also is linked to descent-based slavery. In a nutshell, though, I would say that if I'm, and I would get some some criticism from this from some academics and activists, but just in terms of a simple definition that everyone can get behind, the idea of modern slavery is the exploitation of another individual for gain. That can be monetary gain, that can be, kind of, I would say, you know, personal gain, but that's in a nutshell, the exploitation of another individual, for personal profit or gain.
And this is actually a widespread problem. This is not isolated to one part of the world. It's not, and many products are involved. Is that right?
Yes, that's certainly true. And obviously, the globalization in recent decades and the shifting of industry to Southeast Asia has massively seen this become a problem whereby now many of the products that we take for granted in the West, whether that's the clothes we buy, the smartphones, the laptops, the food we buy, there's a real risk that at the very end of these supply chains based in countries like India, Thailand, Malaysia, that there's exploitation happening there. And it's complicated. These supply chains are extremely vast. If you take your t-shirt, for example, there can be 16 or 17 steps to the supply chain behind a t-shirt. That goes all the way from the picking of the cotton in the first place to the spinning of that yarn, and then it's processed into fabric, and that fabric is probably transported from one country to another where it's then stitched into the t-shirt. And then, of course, you have the transportation from that factory to the logistics factory before it hits the shelf. Problem is that most companies only have visibility or knowledge of tier one suppliers. That means in a 15-tier supply chain that, you know, West major brands can really only with confidence say that they know what's going on in their first tier suppliers, in the first factory. They don't really know what's going on at the very bottom of those chains. It's very difficult to find out because of the nature now of subcontracting. Audits just kind of aren't up to scratch. So in essence, it means that we as consumers really are relying on the promises of these brands. And the reality is that although brands make the right noises, they have very limited knowledge themselves. And a lot of them are scared to look because they don't want the answers. It's a bit of a Pandora's box for them. The harder they look, the more likely they are to find problems. And then they have to, you know, respond to those problems. And that can mean uncomfortable conversations with local governments, with local NGOs, with shareholders, with consumers. So there are a lot of brands. I think what's really interesting for me is that a few years ago, I went to a conference and I spoke to a major supermarket, the CEO of a major supermarket. And he said, on modern slavery, most brands like to stay in the safety of the pack. No one wants to be left behind. Very few brands want to come out and take leadership because then your name is going to be in the headlines with modern slavery, even if it's a positive development that you are looking deeper into your supply chain and introducing policies that better protect workers. Most companies want to stay in the safety of the pack. They don't want the bad press, but they don't want any press. So I think that's the state of play where we are with how brands see the problem.
Can you give us an idea of the scale? I remember when I was working for you that we were talking about some huge numbers and I think people don't have any idea about.
Yeah, the issue of numbers is really thorny. Without getting too into the weeds, it was in the early 2000s, an academic called Kevin Bales, an American academic who's been based in Britain for a long time, he took a real interest in this issue and wrote one of the first academic books in this issue called Disposable People. He has faced some criticism since then for his methodology or lack thereof. But apparently, and this is rumor, what happened was that he had some conversations with some activists and some business leaders. And a man called Andrew Forrest, who's a mining magnate in Australia, set up an organization called the Walk Free Foundation dedicated to tackling modern slavery. And Bill Gates apparently said to Forrest, you need to quantify this issue, because if you can't put a number on the number of modern slaves worldwide, then you aren't going to get the funding or the interest behind it. What's been interesting since is that the numbers that have been produced have been based on extremely patchy methodologies. So we have a global figure that says that 40.3 million people worldwide are modern slaves, which is an interesting figure because that includes victims of forced marriage, which hasn't always been seen as modern slavery. And that has an easy place in this number. But if we just focus on the 25 million, which is the victims of human trafficking, leaving forced marriage to a side, there's 20 million victims of forced labor and 5 million victims of sex trafficking. Now, the huge concerns about this figure and how it was calculated, because it's based on surveys in about 54 countries. So it's been a number that's been extrapolated from 54 to 193 or so countries. And there's concerns about what was included and what wasn't included. But that's basically a massive underestimate. So it's fair to say that there are tens and tens of millions of victims worldwide. And that there's such a, again, because modern slavery is an umbrella term, these are really different issues we're talking about. So the problem is with that number, although it does give the public a sense of the fact that this is pervasive, this is happening around you, it's not a faraway problem, is that it's a bit simplistic in of itself, I think, in terms of trying to tackle the problem. And because the methodology is not particularly strong, I think a lot of statisticians and academics working in the space would say that with recent estimates, when the number fluctuates, that doesn't necessarily, or it doesn't at all, I should say, show signs of progress or setbacks in the kind of global drive to tackle the issue. So I suppose we don't know, unfortunately, whether we're making progress or not. I would argue that maybe before coronavirus, we're moving in the right direction, and that COVID-19, like so many human rights issues, has just put a spanner in the works.
And money-wise, we're talking about billions of dollars.
Yeah, again, it's not an estimate and undoubtedly an underestimate, but the United Nations International Labour Organization, or ILO, estimates this is the crime that generates $150 billion a year. That's for traffickers. We could also talk about the benefit to companies and the private sector and state-sponsored schemes, which wouldn't be counted in that number. And that might be moving a bit more away from the worst forms or the most egregious forms of human trafficking and into the kind of more gray area of labor exploitation, and this idea that there's this continuum of abuses and you need to really also look at smaller labor abuses or vulnerabilities to exploitation if you're serious about preventing human trafficking. The idea that if labor abuses go unchecked, which can be anything from late payments to unpaid overtime to terms that change after the contract signed, if you don't tackle these kind of issues, that it can lead to situations whereby people are exploited more severely or fall into situations of modern slavery because they have been denied their money and have had to take out loans elsewhere or migrate into more risky jobs, so to speak.
Where are the hotbeds? Where's most of the activity?
It's mainly based, I would say, across Asia. I think in real numbers, India would be believed to be home to the biggest proportion of modern slaves. And like I mentioned at the start, we'd be looking at a lot of countries in Asia and Southeast Asia, which are manufacturing hubs. That can be Bangladesh, India, Thailand, Malaysia, China, of course. But it's happening in every country. I think what's been interesting is just noticing the shift in perception now from people in the US and people in Britain, name two countries, Australia as well. The idea that this isn't happening just overseas, it's happening around us and we're taking it for granted. One kind of big push in recent years in the UK has been to get the public to think about car washes and nail salons. People will go and get their car washed for £5 to £10, $10 to $15, and not think about why that's so cheap, because there are Eastern European men mainly working in these car washes who are probably getting paid a fraction of the minimum wage, who are working 12, 14 hour days, who are having their documents withheld, being forced to live in squalid conditions. And it's the same with Vietnamese women often in hair and nail salons in the UK. So it's also just trying to get the public to realize that it's not a distant problem that they don't have to worry about.
And it's huge in food production too, right?
Yeah. In particular, in 2015, the Associated Press did a massive series of investigations into modern slavery in the Thai seafood industry. So a lot of Southeast Asian migrants, Burmese and Indonesian migrants in particular, working in seafood production in Thailand. Now, that was fascinating because that had real impact in terms of, so I think, some of the most impressive impact to date of journalism when it comes to modern slavery issues. And that really forced the government to reform working policies. It really pressured big brands to actually invest more in their supply chain in Thailand and take this issue seriously. I think what's a little bit sad to see, though, is it just seems that's good for anyone who's working in the Thai seafood industry, that standards have been raised, albeit not by much, I would argue. But the issue is that it's just so easy for production to shift elsewhere. And we see that in so many countries. And I think to speculate, you're going to see that more now in Africa, that production will slowly but surely shift from Asian nations to African nations as they develop as manufacturing hubs. We have a correspondent in Ethiopia. Ethiopia doesn't have a minimum wage. So there are Ethiopian garment workers who are earning a dollar or two a day if they're fortunate, and they have no legal recourse to demand or expect more. And I think that's the depressing thing, is that as one country or industry cleans up its act, the problem can very quickly shift elsewhere.
We're going to pause here for a break. You're listening to Angry Plant. We'll be right back.
Hold up. Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
All right, welcome back. You are listening to Angry Planet.
It doesn't seem that any country, developed countries, aren't immune, not necessarily to huge swaths of... No, I'm going to take it back, because in the United States, we have a serious issue with agriculture, with people, many reports of people picking crops where their papers are withheld, and that they're making tiny fractions of what an American would make. That counts in the problem too, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not sure I'm crystal clear on this because I read something briefly a few weeks ago or months ago, but I know the HS2 visa in the US, which is for temporary agriculture workers, that there's talk of a, or whether it's confirmed or just being proposed, that there was talk of a real terms pay freeze for the next few years on that visa. And of course, that means that although it might not seem like a big deal, as inflation, you know, inflation increases in the next few years, anyone on that visa is then going to really struggle to make ends meet. And then they will be then pressured to work longer hours or perhaps to do other risky work to supplement their income. And it just shows again in so many countries now that the lack of standards or rights for foreign workers compared to local workers, and how that really drives so many, I would say, foreign workers, any given country, into the shadows, especially in countries like Britain and the US at the moment, or say at the moment. By the time this goes out, we might be under a Biden administration. Let's say under Trump or under the Republicans in the US and Conservative government in the UK. What's bizarre about these nations is you have US and UK have been very vocal on anti-trafficking efforts in recent years. Trump particularly made it a headline issue, really. But it's at odds with anti-immigration policy. I think the consensus would be in the anti-trafficking movement. You cannot lead on anti-trafficking. You cannot really be serious about anti-trafficking if you're also anti-immigration. Because the problem is, if you're setting out from an anti-immigration stance, then you are going to drive victims of trafficking into the shadows. They are going to be afraid to come forward and speak out if they fear that they'll be criminalized, that they believe that they will be detained or deported or won't be granted in the US as a T visa, a humanitarian visa for victims of trafficking. In the UK, there is also an avenue to remain. In both countries, we're seeing those numbers go down because there is this well-founded fear. So, you know, this is something I've challenged the US anti-trafficking ambassador on, I've challenged UK politicians on. But it's interesting because the public just hears the rhetoric, which is we are doing everything to fight trafficking. And what's really fascinating, to go back to QAnon a little bit, is that you very much have this really entrenched and outdated narrative with trafficking of the bad guys, the villains, this idea that there are the bad guys of the traffickers and the helpless victims. Well, it's much more nuanced and insidious than that. And the reason that politicians in the US and the UK paint it like this is it shifts away the blame from them. It says these are bad guys who are going to do this no matter what. And it shifts any attention away from the immigration policies that actually fuel trafficking. And it gives this very simplistic black and white narrative that people can get behind and is hard to challenge. It also kind of takes agency away from the victims. You know, many victims of trafficking, by definition, you know, although that they are being exploited, for many of them, for many Eastern Europeans in the UK or Mexicans or Central Americans in the US, yeah, we or a law enforcement official might say they are victims of slavery, they're being exploited. But for them to earn a few dollars or pounds a day is better than nothing at home. A lot of them don't want to be rescued. They don't see themselves as victims. The agency is often taken away from them. And I think that's a real frustration in the space that victims are often spoken for and over, and we don't often get their perspective. It's a really complicated issue. And I know that law enforcement officers often struggle with this because they, by the law, by the letter of the law, want to go and by the standards of the US or UK, want to go and help these, you know, victims in inverted commas. But it's really difficult. It's really difficult then what happens next in terms of support for them, getting them to get involved in investigations, prosecutions, and your next steps in terms of whether they have the right to remain in the country or whether they are locked up or sent home.
So a big part of this is sex trafficking. I think, so we said earlier, could be 5 million people, something that's very rough numbers as we talked about. But in some ways, that's the headline story. That's the part that people find most fascinating. What you were just saying about people who are willing participants, does that count in that industry as well?
That's a great question. I think it's complicated. I think what's fascinating about sex trafficking, and we've seen this particularly, I would argue, in the US, is that sex trafficking is such a bipartisan issue. And the US has long focused on sex trafficking because it's less contentious than labor trafficking. When you come down to issues of labor exploitation and labor rights, and you very quickly get into this partisan world of regulation and globalization and trade tariffs, and you know, you can't really get Republicans and Democrats around a table, I would say, easily on labor trafficking, although it's the bigger problem. You know, there's this background to sex trafficking that it's, I think the problem is there's still a lot of morality wrapped up with the issue of sex trafficking. A lot of organizations worldwide, yes, in the US, in the UK, in Thailand, India, a lot of organizations that tackle sex trafficking have a religious affiliation or background, which muddies the waters because there's this whole idea of the savior complex. There's this idea that they're, you know, saving women in sex trafficking from the sin of sex. And we've seen this a lot recently with Exodus Cry, this organization that has been, you know, instrumental in pressuring Pornhub to change its policies. So it's a murky issue because essentially, yes, of course, sex trafficking is a huge problem, but it's such a nuanced issue. And I think the worry is that you have willing sex workers, in many cases, autonomous, free sex workers who get swept up in these anti-trafficking raids or operations, or they get mislabeled. And also you have the problem that victims of sex trafficking, yeah, they're often, rescue and rehabilitation is often through a religious lens, which, you know, isn't going to be appropriate in many cases. So I think that it's a muddy picture. It's a cloudy picture. I would argue compared to labor trafficking, though, I would say there's probably less, maybe it's a little clearer as to who's the victim, you know, or to that question identity of a victim, but it's still such a gray and murky area. And I just think one of the main problems is that everybody from government to law enforcement, just, you know, to organizations that have an agenda or funding, funding to do a certain job, that they want to paint this or see it as a more black and white issue. And that doesn't help anybody from informing the public to supporting victims to changing kind of the landscape or reducing vulnerabilities that drive people into situations and then policies that keep them trapped there.
That is, it's fascinating to hear the nuance because I think the biggest issue around QAnon is this incredible myth that poor little blonde white children are kidnapped from their families and forced into sex trafficking or into sexual slavery, and that somehow this is a large problem. We had one case of Elizabeth Smart in Utah, and just this belief that's actually widespread. Can you talk a little bit about how widespread is it?
I think that's the thing. I think that this, and I think films like Taken have not helped. I think a lot of anti-trafficking activists say that film is one of the biggest stains on the anti-trafficking movement because people love Liam Neeson and a good action film, and they see his daughter in Paris taken off the streets. And people believe that just, yes, of course, that happens in isolated incidents. But sex trafficking is not kidnapping of people off the street. It's not kidnapping of kids off the street. In so many cases, sex trafficking is perpetrated by an individual that's known to the victim. And again, it's often a case of women being offered jobs abroad. There's a big issue with Nigerian women being sex trafficked to Europe. They go to Libya and then are taken to Italy. And yeah, these are young women who aren't particularly well-educated or trained in a particular job, and they get told there will be a cleaner abroad, a hairdresser. They arrive in the West and they're told they have to pay off huge debts of $20,000 to $30,000 at the very least, and they are forced then into sex work. You will also have other situations, and I think this is increasingly the case in many contexts, where women will know that they're going abroad to do sex work. So I would say 15, 20 years ago, they would believe they were doing a different job and would be tricked or duped. Now, in many cases, they will know. What they won't know is the debt aspect, the fact that they are being told that their journey will, they're told that the fee, let's say, the recruitment fee, the fee for the travel and the accommodation will be a few thousand dollars, and that may take a year to pay off or a relatively short amount of time. They arrive in the destination country, or let's say even internally in one country from region to region, and they're then told they owe an amount 10 times that, and which will take 20 or 30 years to pay off. And they are then, of course, there'll be threats. If you leave us, you're undocumented in this country. We'll tell the authorities. If you go to the police, they will arrest you. They will send you home empty-handed, and you will be a failure back home. Or we're from your village. We're from your town. We have people who know your family. We're watching your family right now. So it just comes back to what I said at the start of this call. It's that fraud and deception, but it's also the coercion. It's this element of control that means that situations can so swiftly change. You know, and there's a lot of conflation in the media, really guilty of this, between smuggling and trafficking. So the difference is that smuggling is, by definition, illegal crossing of borders. So the way to explain it is that smuggling is a crime against the state, whereas trafficking is the kind of the coercion or exploitation of someone for gain is a trafficking against the individual. So trafficking can happen internally. Someone could be trafficked from New York to California, for example. But the problem is that what often happens is that people who are smuggled become victims of trafficking along the way. So again, it just goes back to this idea that victims of trafficking are not helpless, uninformed people in many cases, or even in most cases. They're people who have no options at home. Either they may have the full picture, or they may be misled. But what happens is often then the nature of kind of the control and the coercion once they arrive in their destination. And that's where then often the exploitation, the shift, let's say, from smuggling to trafficking can occur.
Why do you think there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of actual crimes going on here? Why do you think that all this stuff gets conflated and blown into these weird conspiracy theories?
To be honest, QAnon, I can barely make sense of. I think
it's older than QAnon. Like, I remember this stuff from when I was a kid, from the Satanic Panic in the 1980s.
Yeah, I suppose, and I can just speak to really the UK. I think there was moral panic in Britain in early to mid 90s about paedophilia, which is a separate issue, but it all comes down to this idea of the sexual exploitation of people who are vulnerable. And I think what happens is, I think it's hard to argue against sex trafficking. You know, no one is publicly supporting sex trafficking. So I think what that means is that when a politician or a leader or someone with authority or clout or standing, that could be an NGO, a think tank, a university, when they present a position on sex trafficking, it's very hard to challenge that, even if it's based on flawed data, stereotypes, assumptions. I think for so long, and I think that's the problem, and therefore it's more difficult to challenge claims about sex trafficking compared to assertions, say, about labor trafficking. It's been presented as more of a black and white issue, and I think then it's taken on a life of its own to an extent where it went from, I don't know, fears, public fears in the 90s that were probably played up by the media, to Pizzagate, all the way now to this QAnon and Save the Children hashtag.
How do you, if you're an average person, how do you fall into slavery? Is it, I'm going to feel and just guess that in the United States, it's not going to happen, or it's unlikely to happen. But around the world, what's the most common way people fall into it?
I think it's fair to say the majority of victims of modern slavery are migrants. It's when you leave one country for another, because in the vast majority of cases, then you are entering that country illegally, you are undocumented. So it's, and it goes back to this question of debt bondage. I think as soon as you are a middleman, a labor broker, a recruiter, as soon as you are in someone's debt, that really leaves the conditions ripe. And it's a question of changing terms. It's being promised. We see this a lot in Gulf nations in Qatar, where they're building stadiums for the Soccer World Cup, which is due to take place next year. It's when people arrive in a given country already tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And they get told that they will be paid far more than they would be at home, but they get there and the pay is nothing. It's 14, 16 hours a day for a dollar an hour at best. And then they're in a really difficult position because, like I said, if they go to the authorities, they risk being locked up or deported. And I think the problem is that it's not modern slavery, but it all fits into the same narrative. When I was the West Africa correspondent for the Tom Sorides Foundation a few years ago, and I covered the economic migration of young men from Senegal to Europe. What was fascinating is that many of the West African nations surrounding Senegal had issues with drought or with conflict, extremism, repression of certain ethnic groups or political supporters. Senegal was a stable, peaceful democracy. Senegal didn't really have any massive push factor compared to these other nations. Yet the number of young Senegalese men going to Libya and getting these dangerous boats to Italy, where they would end up working awful jobs for long hours for low pay. It's this whole idea that you have these communities where there are so few options and the state isn't helping. And it becomes this vicious cycle and this kind of narrative of you can only succeed abroad. And I think you have that in so many countries now in Africa and South and Central America, across Southeast Asia, where although the odds are really not in your favor, and although I think more and more of the stories are coming home in many of these parts of the world, the picture is not rosy, that you have to believe you're going to be different. Or either you believe you'll be a rare success story, that you might get lucky with a fair employer, or maybe you'll find a route to citizenship or a visa in that country, or more and more so that, okay, it's going to be tough out there. I'm going to get paid very little. I'm going to get overworked. In some cases, I'm going to be treated like a modern slave, as we might say in the West. But again, that's preferable to nothing at home or being considered a failure. So I think there's often this narrative for communities which are heavily dependent on remittances, that if you don't go to migrate, then you're seen as a loser, as a failure. And again, that I think that traps many migrants abroad in situations of exploitation, because again, they don't want to go home empty-handed and be dismissed as a failure. So they will suck it up, so to speak, as awful as the conditions might be.
Kieran, thank you so much for joining us and giving us some of the reality of the situation, tearing away some of the myths.
A pleasure to join you guys. Thanks so much. I think it's a bit of a lonely task at times, but I think that's one of the things we pride ourselves on the Tom Sorides Foundation, is just trying to challenge these myths and misconceptions and just give the context and the nuances and explain the story behind modern slavery and human trafficking, rather than just focusing on these worst forms of abuses. So hopefully we can continue to do that, because we have a really cool team of reporters around the world who tell these really important and reported stories.
That's all for this week, Angry Planet listeners. Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Kevin Nodell, and Jason Fields. It was created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like the show, please subscribe to our Substack at Angry Planet Pod. There you get a weekly newsletter and two bonus episodes a month for just $9. Again, that's at angryplanetpod.com. The most recent is a collective freakout with Jason Stanley. We talk about fascism and what we think might happen to the Trump movement now that Trump is gone. Check it out. Again, it's angryplanetpod.com. We will be back next week for another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.